There has to come a point at which you say, enough.
Says you.
I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, People Powered Radio in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast at 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove. On 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM. And on AM 950, KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. This is the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Back from a quick day off following the conventions, the two conventions. My thanks to Angie Coiro of In Deep Radio for giving us a short breather, which we needed. I don't know about you, Desi Doyen.
Oh, yeah. I needed it. No. I needed it, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
That was a whole lot of politics all at once.
Yes, it was. Just a difficult 2 weeks to cover and following on a whole bunch of even more difficult weeks prior to that. So we needed it. We could use a lot more time off, but we are back nonetheless. And after not just those 2 weeks, by the way, of convention madness, but also after all of the very, very good voting rights news that came in on Friday, and we only covered a part of it on this program. One of the court cases, the landmark voting rights case, I believe, in North Carolina that happened on Friday. There were more. There were two others that came in on Friday and some more since then. We will be talking about what is really very good news for voting rights, something you rarely hear on this program. Very good news for voting rights with Julie Ebenstein of the ACLU shortly. In the meantime, well, that was quick. What a difference a convention makes, or a few days make since that convention, or the difference that an attack on the parents of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq apparently make. So remember the forecast that I shared with you last week from Nate Silver's data journalism site, 538.com. Reporting on the win probabilities for both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton based on all the existing data and polls, etc., that 538 includes in their computer simulations. So based on all of that information, if the election were held that very day last week when we reported on this, this was a series of days actually last week during the conventions, they took all that data, they simulated the election if it were held that day by their computer 20,000 times. And then they predict the distribution of possible outcomes for each state and then the winner of the presidential race based on that simulation. Well, last week, based on that data, if the election were held that day, Donald Trump had a 55% probability of winning the election at that time. Hillary Clinton had just a 45% chance of winning. Again, based on all of that information, all of the polls that they collate from all over the country, national polls, state polls, etc. Well, a slew of new polling numbers have now come out since we were on with you last week, since the convention, in a bunch of states and nationally as well. The polls were taken both near the end of and then after the DNC convention in Philadelphia. And boy, howdy, has the outlook for November changed, at least based on the data available today. It changed a big time, or big league, as Donald Trump might say, in favor of Hillary Clinton. According to that same computer simulation over there at 538.com, again, using the latest data, 20,000 times in their simulation, running the election across the country, the probability of Hillary Clinton now defeating Donald Trump, it had been 45%, remember, with Donald Trump leading at 55%.
Right.
Now, the probability of Hillary Clinton winning, if the election were held today, 83.5%.
Wow. That's quite a switcheroo.
You think? Trump's probability of winning, if the election were held today, 16.5%. So it's gone from 55-45 Trump to 83-16 Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Wow. And this is reflected in a bunch of polls across the country, including places like, for example, Missouri, which when I grew up there used to be a swing state. Actually, when Bill Clinton was running back in the 90s, Clinton and George W. Bush Sr., they would come out to St. Louis, Missouri all the time because it was considered a swing state. And in the years since I left, so yes, I blame myself, Missouri has become considered to be a red state. Well, now, new poll from Mason-Dixon Polling finds that Hillary Clinton actually leads Donald Trump in Missouri, in the Show Me State, 41% to 40%. So just 1 point. But Hillary Clinton is leading Donald Trump in Missouri. Libertarian presidential nominee Gary Johnson ranks third in the state with 9%. Green Party candidate Jill Stein takes 1%. Another 9% are undecided. But the fact that Hillary Clinton is even within the margin of error in Missouri should tell you quite a bit. By the way, based on that Mason-Dixon poll, 51% see Trump unfavorably, while just 45% view Clinton unfavorably. So Trump's unfavorability is up in Missouri. The pollster here, Mason-Dixon pollster Brad Coker, told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, really, Missouri right now looks like a turnout game, which is really kind of the same thing that is going on nationally. It's a matter of whoever is more successful in convincing their people that their candidate isn't as bad as the other one wins, says the Mason-Dixon poll. Now, it's not just Missouri. Harry Enten, also from 538.com, notes that Trump and Clinton are tied in Georgia. In Georgia, they are tied. And Hillary Clinton is leading by 1% in, get ready, Utah.
Wow.
So it's just kind of amazing if you go on a state-by-state basis, at least as of now. As I said, things change quickly around here. Meanwhile, nationally, Hillary Clinton emerges from her party's convention in Philadelphia with a restored lead over Donald Trump. She has earned a 7-point convention bounce, at least according to the new CNN ORC poll. In a two-way head-to-head matchup, Clinton now leads Trump by, is this right? Yeah, 9 points, 52% to 43%. Clinton over Trump by 9 points. In a four-way matchup, including Johnson and Stein from the Libertarian and Green parties, Clinton leads 45 to 37. So an 8-point lead, even with the other two candidates, the other two party candidates included in that poll. So she's had a big jump coming out of the convention.
And that's fairly typical, is it not?
It used to be typical. They used to get more bumps than they have in recent years.
Ah, okay.
Actually, her bump is about, it depends which poll you're looking at, but her bump, let's see here, the CBS News poll found a similar bump. 46% of voters say they'll vote for Clinton in November. Just 39 say they'll back Trump. So that's a 7-point lead there for Hillary Clinton in that particular, in the CBS News poll. And if you include the leaners, people who are not sure but might lean towards a candidate, in that case, Clinton leads Trump by 6 points. But the bump there was similar to what they saw with Barack Obama in his last two elections. So it's typical that they get some sort of a bump. It looks like hers is better than what Donald Trump got after his convention, though he did get a bump himself as well. So nearly half of registered voters, according to CNN, say that what they saw or read at the Democratic convention left them feeling more likely to vote for Clinton versus 39% who said it turned them off from supporting her. Trump's convention merited a slight negative tilt on that same question, according to CNN ORC. 42% said they would be more apt to back Donald Trump after the convention, while 44% said they would be less likely to back Donald Trump after watching the GOP convention. So in the meantime, when it comes to Bernie Sanders supporters, despite the regular interruption from the Sanders supporters, according to CNN, delegates inside the convention hall, the interruptions inside the convention hall, it appears to have bolstered unity for the party, for Democratic unity overall, and strengthened her position among Sanders voters. Among Democrats and independents who lean towards the Democratic Party, 84% now feel that the party will be united this November. That's up from 75% before either convention. And those who say they would rather have seen the party nominate Sanders, among the Sanders backers, in other words, they now go 69% for Clinton, 13% for Jill Stein, 10% for Gary Johnson, and just 3% say they will back Donald Trump.
Okay, so there's that.
Yeah, so 3% still say they'll vote for Donald Trump, claim to vote for Bernie Sanders, support Bernie Sanders, and yet they're willing to support Donald Trump.
Who
really
represents the exact opposite of pretty much everything that Sanders has called for.
It's, by the way, a 5-point improvement for Hillary Clinton among those Bernie Sanders supporters, according to CNN. So what else do we have here? Oh, yeah. So this is now we're looking. Real Clear Politics now has the national average, taking all of these national polls into account, putting Clinton over Trump by about 4.5%. So still not all that much, still within an easy margin of error. And of course, those are national numbers. Pay more attention to the state numbers. In the meantime, you can also pay attention to self-identified conservative voters, people who believe they are conservative. Well, their support apparently for Donald Trump is collapsing, according to Steve Portnoy over at CBS. Trump's support among self-identified conservatives in their new CBS News poll is at 64%. But Bush, back in 2004, his support among conservatives was 84%. For McCain, it was 78%. For Romney, it was 82%. But for Trump, among self-ID'd conservatives, 64%. Portnoy goes on to say that perhaps the most startling finding in the CBS News poll, among self-described conservatives, 21% now say they'll vote for Clinton over Trump. 21%. Of conservative people call themselves conservative. That's it. Only 21% of them will say they will vote for Clinton over Trump. And as a matter of fact, the guy, the managing editor over at Red State, which is this, you know, right wing conservative website, the guy, the managing editor there over there, Leon Wolf, says, "I don't have a party registration card for the registration for the Republican Party, but if I did, I would burn it." He says he is done with the Republican Party. He is so embarrassed by what is going on. But not everybody is embarrassed, even given Donald Trump's attack in recent days against the parents of this Muslim American soldier who was killed back in Iraq in 2004. They spoke out. The parents, the Khans, spoke out during the Democratic election. I'm sure you heard about this. Everybody's been talking about it. Angie Cordero talked about it yesterday on the broadcast. Well, a lot of people are denouncing Trump for attacking those Muslim parents, essentially. Kazir Khan repeated his call for House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to repudiate Trump, saying they have a moral obligation to speak out against their party's standard bearer. However, Ryan and McConnell, while they expressed support for the Khans, they reiterated their opposition to Trump's proposed ban on Muslims, but neither mentioned Donald Trump by name and neither abandoned his support for the Republican nominee. We're seeing that all over the place. Now, John McCain did mention Donald Trump by name, said that he has disparaged a fallen soldier's parents. He suggested that the likes of their son should not be allowed in the United States, to say nothing of entering its service. I cannot emphasize enough how deeply I disagree with Mr. Trump's statement. That said, John McCain had said he was going to vote for whoever the Republican nominee was, and he has not unendorsed Donald Trump in that regard. He has not said that he would not vote for Donald Trump. And those who have previously not endorsed Donald Trump, people like Jeb Bush and Lindsey Graham, obviously, you know, they have been rebuking Donald Trump for his comments, but none of them are saying that they will vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And if they really are concerned about Donald Trump, why aren't they coming out and saying, yeah, Donald Trump is so bad, I will vote for Hillary Clinton? So Lindsey Graham, he condemned what Trump said. He claimed that, you know, the GOP has a tradition of not attacking Gold Star parents, which, by the way, is not true.
True. That's right.
Anybody remember Cindy Sheehan? Name ring a bell? Jesus Christ. They went after her like crazy. We were out there at the time back in 2005 in Crawford, Texas, covering that on this program. You know, so the idea that, no, they don't attack gold-starred parents is nonsense. Nonetheless, all right, Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, put your money where your mouth is. Why don't you say you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton? If Donald Trump is such a danger, such a menace to the country and to your party, why don't you, you know, say you will vote for Hillary Clinton? So I had been thinking about this for the last few days as I've seen these reports coming in. It's like, you know, they're... When they condemn, fine. But they often don't do it by name, and they don't unendorse, and they don't say that, okay, we're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama, as it turns out, speaking just this morning, apparently he's inside my head. Apparently he heard my thoughts on this, and at a joint press conference on Tuesday with the Prime Minister of Singapore, the president was asked by a reporter if, based on Donald Trump's most recent comments, if he believed that Trump was unfit for the office of president. He said that Trump appeared to lack basic knowledge of critical foreign policy issues, and he was critical about the fact that these Republicans were failing to unendorse him.
Yes, I think the Republican nominee is unfit to serve as president. I think what's been interesting is the repeated denunciations of his statements by leading Republicans. And the question I think that they have to ask themselves is, if you are repeatedly having to say in very strong terms that what he has said is unacceptable, why are you still endorsing him? What does this say about your party that this is your standard bearer? This isn't a situation where you have an episodic gaffe. This is daily and weekly where they are distancing themselves from statements he's making. There has to be a point at which you say, this is not somebody I can support for President of the United States. Even if he purports to be a member of my party. And you know, the fact that that has not yet happened makes some of these denunciations ring hollow. I don't doubt their sincerity. I don't doubt that they were outraged about some of the statements that Mr. Trump and his supporters made about the Khan family. But there has to come a point at which you say, somebody who makes those kinds of statements doesn't have the judgment, the temperament, the understanding to occupy the most powerful position in the world. Because a lot of people depend on the White House getting stuff right. And that's not just my opinion. That is the opinion of many prominent Republicans. There has to come a point at which you say, enough.
Well, you'd think, but apparently we're not yet at that point. That was Barack Obama calling the nominee for president of the United States for the Republican Party unfit for office. I mean, obviously, he's partisan. We see that, you know, all the time in elections. But what we don't see is calling the nominee unfit. Kind of remarkable. And yes, these people have not unendorsed, although there is one. We now have the first one. We now have the first Republican to...
The first rat to jump ship?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, you know, rats from a sinking ship.
That's kind of mean.
Item. That's what I meant.
Wow. So mean, Desi Doyen.
Sorry.
U.S. Congressman Richard Hanna, a three-term Republican, said on Tuesday that he will vote for Hillary Clinton for president because Donald Trump is, quote, unfit to serve our party and cannot lead this country. He's the first Republican member of Congress to publicly declare that he will vote for Hillary Clinton in November. Now, mind you, he's retiring. So maybe it's easier for him to do this on the way out the door. But he said he could never support Trump. Previously he had said that before, but he had stopped short of backing Clinton. Now he's saying, yep, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton. He represents an 8-county district in upstate New York. He said in an interview that he considered giving his support to Clinton for several months and finally decided to take action this week after watching Trump criticize the Muslim American parents of a U.S. Army captain killed in Iraq. He said, I saw that and felt incensed. He added, I think Trump is a national embarrassment. Is he really the guy you want to have the nuclear codes? It should be noted, however, that he has frequently split with his GOP colleagues on social issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. And Desi Doyen, he is among only 13 Republican House members to even acknowledge that humans have contributed to climate change.
Okay, well, that explains a lot then.
There you go. So that's it. That's all we got. In the meantime, we do have an election ahead, and we had some remarkable news on Friday concerning voting rights restrictions by these same Republicans in places like North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Kansas, and more. And we will be talking about that next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.
Yeah, it happens to be true this time.
No one could be sweeter.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, listen, I know it's not fashionable in the talk radio biz to discuss good news. We're supposed to be simply outraged by something or other each and every day in each and every segment. But the Bradcast don't roll that way, especially not when we've got just such a spate of remarkably good news on an issue that we follow perhaps closer than anybody else on the air, to be frank, voting rights. And many cases here in the past few, about 10 days, have been incredibly good court news. We have had a huge spate of shockingly encouraging news on the voting rights front this year and just within the last 2 weeks. There are still many reasons to be worried about the outcome of this year's elections from the top of the ticket on down. But in regard to the voter suppression laws that Republicans have been putting in place all over the country in states where they control the legislature and the governor's mansion, particularly following the U.S. Supreme Court's 2013 decision that gutted the central part of the Voting Rights Act, requiring pre-clearance for new election laws in jurisdictions with a long history of racial discrimination, those restrictive laws, making it harder to vote and otherwise restricting the franchise by making it harder for certain demographics, specifically here, generally Democratic-leaning demographics, such as minorities, the poor, students, the elderly, laws that have most likely would never have been implemented had the full protections of the Voting Rights Act still been in place. Those laws, laws that have been challenged by voting rights advocates now for years in courtrooms, are finally being cut down, and in several cases by conservative judges and courts, for that matter. On Friday, on the broadcast, we covered the huge breaking news out of North Carolina from the full Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals there, striking down most of the provisions of that state's massive voter suppression law. The court there actually joined me in characterizing that law as the worst since the Jim Crow era, finding that the law put in place by Republicans just days after the Supreme Court had gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, had mandated draconian photo ID restrictions at the polls, it shortened early voting, it killed same-day registration, ended early voter registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, it barred the tabulation of provisional ballots in the wrong precinct. All of those provisions were nixed on Friday by the Fourth Circuit in a landmark ruling that determined the provisions had, quote, targeted African-American voters with almost surgical precision. That ruling, handed down in North Carolina just before we went to air on Friday, wasn't the only very good news ruling that came down that same day, as we similarly saw later on in the day encouraging rulings from courts in Wisconsin, Kansas, following on more good news out of courts just days earlier, such as the Fifth Circuit in Texas, the nation's most conservative federal court, about a week earlier. As Ari Berman wrote at The Nation yesterday, six major GOP voting restrictions have been blocked in 2 weeks. The Republican war on voting rights, he says, is backfiring. He details, in the past 10 days, courts have issued six major decisions against GOP-backed voting restrictions in five different states. On Friday, an array of new voting restrictions were struck down in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, and Kansas. That followed rulings the previous week, softening voter ID laws in Texas and Wisconsin, and striking down Michigan's ban on straight ticket voting. Berman writes, when you include a court decision in Ohio from May reinstating a week of early voting and same-day registration, anti-voting laws in six states have been blocked so far in 2016. And he wrote that before another court ruling in North Dakota, this is late on Monday, struck down that state's photo ID law because it was found as discriminatory to Native American voters. Now, many of these rulings in courts come thanks in no small part to voting rights champions like the NAACP and the ACLU, which has long been challenging these restrictions on voting rights all over the country. Now, while you're out fighting for or against your favorite or most loathed candidates, the ACLU is out there fighting to make sure you can cast that vote at all. Joining us now to discuss what seems to me to be a sea change in the November outlook for voting rights, at least at this point, and to caution us, no doubt, about some of the remaining concerns in those states and many others, is Julie Ebenstein. She's a staff attorney with the ACLU Voting Rights Project. She's focused on challenging the proliferation of voter suppression laws throughout the country, and has been the staff attorney previously with the ACLU of Florida, counsel in several voting rights cases, including litigation preventing reduction to early voting, challenging Florida's voter purge, and more. Yeah, you're familiar with it. Julie Ebenstein, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks very much, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So good to have you here. And I want to cover some of these specific rulings around the country, Julie. Happily, and this never happens, that there may be more good news than we have time to cover. But I also want to look at the big picture. So obviously, I'm quite encouraged by this spate of very good voting news, voting rights news of late. There are concerns out there, but am I overstating the amount of really good and surprisingly good news that we're suddenly seeing here on this front over the past few days?
No, I think you're right on the mark. It's really been an exciting couple of weeks. We've seen, like you said, courts in six different states strike down suppressive voting laws. We've seen both state courts and federal courts, including federal appeals courts, decide that the burdens that have been placed on voting since 2013 are either unconstitutional or in violation of the Voting Rights Act. It looks like there's going to be much stronger protection leading up to the 2016 election than we had thought. So it's really very encouraging, and it is nice to get to talk about good news.
Yeah, for a change. The Voting Rights Act, which is violated in a number of these laws as determined by these courts. A lot of people, you know, we report that the Voting Rights Act was gutted by the Supreme Court back in 2013, and it was, and yet these laws are found to violate the Voting Rights Act. Can you very quickly just explain how it is that the Voting Rights Act was both gutted and still protecting voters in many of these cases?
Sure. So we're talking about two different sections of the Voting Rights Act. The section of the Voting Rights Act that was gutted in 2013 with the Shelby County decision is Section 5. And what that provision provided was protection only for some states, where the state would have to seek preclearance from the federal government, either the Department of Justice or a three-judge panel out of the D.C. District Court. The state would need that sort of preclearance before they could implement any law that affected voting. And I mean anything as small as moving a polling place or as large as something like the North Carolina law that you mentioned a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did states have to seek preclearance from the federal government, but the burden was on the state to show that the law wouldn't be retrogressive and have a negative effect on minority voters. That provision was pretty much taken out of operation by the Supreme Court in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's still Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and that applies nationwide and provides protection against racial discrimination in voting. The issue there is that the law can be implemented before there's a court's determination or any federal determination on whether or not it violates the Voting Rights Act. So what you've seen in a lot of the states you just mentioned is that these laws are put into effect, for example, in North Carolina in August of 2013, and immediately there are lawsuits challenging that law. We sued the day that the law went into effect in 2013, and now 3 years later, we've received a decision after a full trial from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So you can see the problem there. It's difficult to have elections go forward with laws that may very well be unconstitutional or a violation of the Voting Rights Act, and to find out later that that's the case. So there is still protection for voting rights and protection against racial discrimination, both in the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution, but we are missing a key provision at this point.
And that means without that key provision, these laws go in place. As you said, Julie Ebenstein, you challenge the, you can file the suit, but it has to play out. It doesn't block it the way the preclearance from Section 5 would have done in prior to 2013. So you have this long process for all of these laws. You have elections that are held under these unconstitutional and or violative violations of the Voting Rights Act. But the laws move forward. The elections move forward anyway, even with these bad laws. And it's a number of years before anything can be done about it. Now, are you surprised by some of these rulings that we have seen in the past few days? Or did you see them coming? Did you know they would come? But it was just a matter of working through the court process now that you have to go through with Section 2, unlike Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, I'm encouraged with all the rulings. It was surprising to get so many rulings in such a short period of time and a bit a bit overwhelming. But I'm not surprised that the courts are still finding that there's protection for voting rights. And given how extreme and egregious some of these laws are, I'm not surprised that the courts have found that they violate the Constitution. So I think a lot of these laws have really gone very far to put barriers in the way of voters, and in many instances, particularly in the way of black voters. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that the courts have said, you may not have Section 5, but what you're doing still violates the Constitution.
In a number of these states, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Texas, with the arguably the most conservative appellate court in the nation, in the, the Fifth Circuit down there in Texas, all have blocked photo ID restrictions within the past few days. Are we finally seeing the end to these discriminatory photo ID laws around the country, or will they continue to move forward? I know you work in Missouri. Missouri is trying to get it on the ballot, a constitutional provision for their state constitution for a photo ID restriction. But are some of these rulings finally ending this photo ID nonsense, this fiction, or is this going to make its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court and be found at some point constitutional, and we'll see these photo ID restrictions all over the country?
Well, we certainly hope that this would end the continued passage of laws like these for the voter's sake. It's very expensive both to try to implement a voter ID law and to defend against a federal court challenge, which we're now seeing has quite a good likelihood of winning and finding the law unconstitutional or unlawful in the end. So we've seen in North Carolina striking down a photo ID law, in North Dakota, in Texas, in Wisconsin, striking it down either in its entirety or a particular part of that law. I would think that this would discourage legislators from moving forward with these sorts of laws, but of course that can be difficult to predict. At the very least, we're seeing that courts are willing to step in and recognize that these laws are can't go forward for elections. So certainly that's encouraging. And I think that these court cases or these court decisions really show a few different things. One is that not everyone can comply with these restrictions. And I think that's a hurdle for some people to really picture. I might say, oh, but if I get on an airplane, I have to show ID. If I do other things, drive a car, I may have to show ID. It takes some people a moment to realize that not everyone flies, not everyone drives, not everyone has a home. We have homeless veteran clients who are certainly still entitled to and encouraged to exercise their fundamental right to vote. We have older clients, one who's a World War II veteran, who doesn't have sufficient ID and would be unable to vote if it were not for these lawsuits. So there's a broader recognition that this is really disenfranchising people in a very practical day-to-day sense. I think the other thing that the laws have highlighted is that they're just not justified. They're, as North Carolina put it, the laws constitute solutions in search of a problem. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we've been saying since the beginning. There's no evidence, or absolutely minimal evidence, of any sort of voter impersonation, which is what these laws purport to protect against. Mm-hmm. So you have laws that will disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters or potential voters, and the only justification for them is maybe, at most, a showing of one or two instances where there's been some difficulty, oftentimes that was caught, having to do with somebody voting where they weren't eligible. It's shocking when you look at the harm that these laws cause and the lack of justification that they were passed in the first place.
And I should also note, since you mentioned the requirement for an ID when getting on an airplane, it's actually not a requirement. They'll ask you for a photo ID. Well, it's only important because when I see that, you know, coming up in court cases, what was it, Frank Easterbrook up in the 10th Circuit, I think it was, one of the Wisconsin decisions?
Seventh.
You know, claiming that, hey, you need an ID to get on a plane. In truth, you don't. You can go to the TSA website. You can see they will ask you for an ID when you board a plane. But if you don't have one, they have provisions to make sure that you can get on that plane anyway. They have databases and so forth. It'll be a bit more hassle, but you will get on that plane most likely. Not so when it comes to these photo ID laws. If you don't have the type of ID that is now required by some of these laws, you lose your vote, period. There are no, you know, special provisions for the, 30 or 35 million American legally registered American voters who don't have the type of ID required under these laws. Now, Julie Ebenstein of the ACLU, what are the possibilities here now that the Supreme Court can still mess up these otherwise good court rulings? In 2014, for example, we saw a number of encouraging decisions on discriminatory laws at the U.S. District Court and at the Federal Appeals Court level, but the Supreme Court undid some of those only because the court rulings came in too late, and the Supreme Court has created this, what they call the Purcell principle in recent years, that disallows changes to election laws, even if they're found to be, you know, unconstitutional, disenfranchising laws, disallows those changes just prior to an election because it's too late. We don't want to cause confusion. Do we have concern that that may happen on some of these rulings from the past week or two at this point at the Supreme Court?
Well, we saw in 2014, we saw the Purcell principle applied in both directions, really. In some instances, mm-hmm. allowing for more protection of voting rights because it was too close to the election to switch gears. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, less protection. So it is a concern of the Supreme Court that when you get too close to an election, trying to change the rules of administration are going to cause harm. Things are moving a lot earlier this year, which is encouraging. So if North Carolina seeks a stay of the Fourth Circuit decision, and no doubt they will, we still have enough time to sort out, for mm-hmm. the Supreme Court to decide whether or not that decision will be stayed and have that in time for North Carolina to apply and administer the Fourth Circuit decision. To allow for greater protection of voting rights. So we're not quite as close to the election this time around mm-hmm. As we were in 2014. So the reasoning behind some of those stays, I believe, really isn't in place. But just to be clear, especially in a place like North Carolina, you know, there's not a cost to administering some of these protections. So you mentioned the out-of-precinct voting provision. Mm-hmm. Whereas before 2013, when the suppressive law was passed, people could vote out of precinct and have their vote counted. After the law was passed, they could cast that same provisional ballot at an out-of-precinct location, but their vote would be thrown out and not counted. As far as the voter, their actions are the same. So it's not asking too much for the state to allow the voter to exercise their fundamental right to vote by counting that ballot. That's not the type of provision that takes a reboot of the entire system. It just asks the elections administrators to treat ballots one way as opposed to another. So for the voter, there's not the risk of confusion with regard to many of these laws.
Is there a likelihood that some of these appeals to the Supreme Court, you mentioned you suspect North Carolina will ask for a stay from the court, is there a chance that they will at this point slow walk the appeal to make it to bring it, you know, as late as possible to the court in order to trigger that Purcell principle to block this or that?
No, that's not likely in these instances. First of all, you're working under a very urgent schedule when you're seeking a stay because mm-hmm. Anyone who's seeking a stay is trying to convince the court that this, despite a valid decision, it has to be urgently stayed so it can be decided very, very quickly. You lose a lot of credibility on that if you drag your feet and wait. And I do believe, win or lose, a lot of states, especially the people who actually administer the election in those states, really want to have this sorted out so they know one way or another what's going to happen in 2016.
There are still some 17 states, as Ari Berman describes at The Nation this week, still some 17 states with new restrictions on voting in place before the November election. As we've noted, this will be the first presidential election without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act. The first time in 50 years, by the way, since it was passed in 1965, and this is the this week, as a matter of fact, is the 51st anniversary of that landmark legislation. I know you've been working, Julie Ebenstein, on felon disenfranchisement yourself for a while, and voting roll purges and so forth. What are your or the ACLU's concerns about the November election at this point? What states, what laws, despite all this good news, should we still be quite concerned about as we move towards November?
Well, like you said, there are a number of laws that are still very recent. And a number of the cases that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, mm-hmm. even though we have a good decision, there's still going to be ongoing challenges. So in some instances, those are preliminary injunctions, and they will still be appealed before the next election. Things do stay in flux for quite some time. So before I go through some of the concerns, mm-hmm. I would just encourage everybody to check right now whether you're registered, make sure your registration is up to date, make sure it has the accurate address on file, and know what the rules are. We're still concerned about voter ID laws either being moved forward, like you said, in Missouri, mm-hmm. or that could possibly still be in place. We're concerned about some of the states where there's a better regime than there would have been without litigation, but that will still require somebody to fill in what's called a reasonable impediment affidavit. So if I don't have identification in Wisconsin, for example, I need to fill out an affidavit. Now, that is decades better than a requirement that I have ID, and if I don't, I can't vote at all. Mm-hmm. But it's still something that we're worried in a presidential election may slow down lines at the polls, mm-hmm. clog up certain polling places, prevent people from being able to cast their ballot because of some of those long lines. We're keeping an eye on voter rolls and what sort of list maintenance states are doing mm-hmm. from now until the election. And of course, we're trying to get out as much accurate information as possible on citizens with a prior felony conviction to make sure that they're aware of whether or not they can vote or what they need to do to be able to vote.
We had some what appeared to be good news a few weeks ago out of Virginia, where the governor there, Terry McAuliffe, had. And I believe I'm right in the right state here, Virginia, where he mm-hmm. had allowed yeah. some 10 or 20,000 former felons who had, you know, served their time, gone through all their probation, their parole, everything else, and it basically reinstated their right to vote in one fell swoop. But then the court came in a few days ago and said, no, you can't do that. The governor has the power to reinstate former felons, voting rights, but can't do it all at once. He's got to do it on a case-by-case basis. And so those felons who had regained their right to vote have since lost their right to vote yet again, it seems. Can you update us on the status of that case, Julie Ebenstein? Any idea where we're at on that one?
Sure, and I'm glad you brought that case up because I fear that it might cause some confusion in Virginia. Mm-hmm. So the governor did remove political disabilities, which means restore people's rights to vote, in 206,000 instances. So over 200,000 citizens who had lost their right to vote because of a felony conviction had already served their time, completed probation and parole, and were back with their community and family, working, paying taxes, going about their life, were still unable to vote. Virginia, up until the governor's action, is one of the real outliers in the country. It's one of only four states that disenfranchise people with a felony conviction for life. The others are Kentucky, Iowa, and, of course, Florida.
Of course.
The governor restored voting rights to 206,000 people. Two state legislators and some individual citizens challenged his authority to do that. And the state Supreme Court decided, like you said, that the governor could not do a blanket restoration for all of these citizens. He had to make a determination on a one-to-one basis. So thankfully, after the court's decision, the governor has said publicly that he will very quickly make sure that each individual's rights are restored. And that's very encouraging. You know, of the 200,000, 13,000 had already gone and registered to vote. We wrote an amicus brief in that case, and we spoke to a number of people who were really encouraged and excited to have their voting rights back after waiting, in some instances, for decades. And if you look at the statistics of who was affected, more often than not, it was nonviolent offenders. More often than not, it was people who completed their sentence more than 10 years ago. This is not some threatening group of people recently convicted and still serving a punishment. These are people who had rehabilitated themselves and just wanted to rejoin society fully instead of being marked for the rest of their life. So it's encouraging that the governor will still restore voting rights, but if someone has had their voting rights restored and registered to vote, they may need to register again. Oh. So the easiest way to, again, that's in flux, so it's a little bit difficult to say in each county. The easiest way to find out is just to call your local county elections officials. Find out if you're registered. Find out if you need to fill out the form again, and that should be easy to do. So we would hate to lose any of these long-waiting, much-deserving citizens from the rolls. I hope everybody makes sure that they're registered again before the election.
Wow, 200,000 voter registrations potentially up for grabs there. We got just another minute or so here, Julie, and this may or may not be easy to do in a minute, but Kansas, it is actually election day in Kansas. There has long been a fight with that Secretary of State there. Chris Kobach, Republican Secretary of State, has been they put in place a citizenship requirement, a proof of citizenship. And if you couldn't prove that or you didn't prove your citizenship, you were being kept from voting. Courts have decided on a federal level. Many of those voters can vote, but he was still blocking them from voting on a state level as we were heading into Tuesday's state primary in Kansas. There was a decision on those voters. I think it was about 17,000 voters who didn't even know if they could vote in the state primary.
Right. So there's been a lot of movement in Kansas, and it's really shocking that the Secretary of State, who is supposed to be encouraging eligible citizens to vote and streamlining that process, is holding on to a system that will clearly disenfranchise voters. Luckily, we have a state court case, and those rules have been enjoined for the upcoming primary election. So the situation there, very briefly, is that we sued in federal court to make sure that those who registered at the DMV did not need to show documentary proof of citizenship. It's enough that they swore under penalty of perjury that they were a U.S. citizen eligible to vote. Once that decision was put in place, the state went and said, well, that protection is only for federal elections, so we're going to split federal and state elections. Fine, we'll register you for federal elections because the federal court says we have to, but we won't allow you to vote in state elections. A state court last Friday decided that there's no authority for the Secretary of State to conduct this dual system of elections, and that anyone registered to vote through the DMV would be allowed to vote in all elections during the primary. This is not just a problem that one person is facing, this documentary proof of citizenship requirement. Like you said, there's 17,000 people who've been unable to provide documentary proof of citizenship, and we want to make sure that they are able and registered to vote for the upcoming election.
And those voters, at least, are allowed to vote in the state primary as of now, as of that state court decision on Friday.
Yes, they're absolutely allowed to vote in the primary, and there's going to be another hearing on how they'll be treated in the general election come September 21st.
Amazing. In any event, I think I'm going to call last Friday Good Friday. Julie Ebenstein of the staff attorney with the ACLU Voting Rights Project is so helpful. Really appreciate you catching us up on this entire fine mess. I suspect we're going to have to talk about more such messes in the future. Hope you'll come back and make us all smarter.
I'd be glad to, Brett. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Check out Julie Ebenstein and the important work they're doing over at the ACLU at aclu.org. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
All right. Talking about monkeying around with elections, well, I'll explain when we get back. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yeah, they might want to shock the monkeys up in northern Thailand. As it turns out, election officials in northern Thailand think they can buy off a gang of monkey vandals.
Monkey vandals?
Monkey vandals. I know you're looking at me. They're going to buy them off with fresh fruit, or they're at least going to try to buy them off with fresh fruit and vegetables after about 100 macaques. Macaca? How do you say
macaques?
Macaques? I don't know.
Sure.
100 monkeys tore up voter lists publicly ahead of an August referendum on a proposed constitution. the Fitchit election official, oh, I don't even want to try, Prayun Jakralapa Trakarakalu, yeah, said that if feeding the monkeys did not deter them, then newly installed sliding glass doors might if they don't figure out how to open them. So apparently a band of monkeys raided a Thai polling place and tore up the voter lists. The officials speculated that the pink color of the voter lists for the August 7 referendum might have attracted the animals. Two 8-year-old girls in a northern province were charged last week with obstructing the referendum process and destroying public property when they tore down voter lists because the two little girls liked the pink paper on which they were printed.
Oh, boy.
So the little girls and the monkeys, they all like the voter list and tore them up.
And I was thinking of little girls who like the monkeys, the band.
Well,
but not the same
thing. No, not the same thing. Oh, see, we could have played that for the bumper music. In any event, we think we got problems in this country. At least, as far as I know, we don't yet have bands of monkeys actually destroying the voter list.
So there's that.
No, yeah, that's right. No, we have insiders doing it, so you have no idea if the voter list has been destroyed or not. Maybe we'll talk about some of that on our next thrilling episode of the Bradcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our guest today, Julie Ebenstein of the ACLU, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's thrilling, and it was thrilling, program, really happy about good voting rights news. If you missed any portion, download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes or your favorite podcast site, whatever that may be. You can drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Until we meet again, look out for those monkeys. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.